Good morning. This remote meeting of the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee is called to order, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Long.
Present.
Vice Chair Akam.
Present.
Minority Leader Swazinski.
Hey, I gotta go. Committee just started.
Minority Leader Swazinski.
Present.
Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Bowe.
Present.
Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen.
Present.
Representative Hollins. Representative Hollins. Representative Hornstein.
Hornstein present.
Representative Igo.
Igo present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lippertz.
Lippert present.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard present.
Representative Meckland.
Present.
Representative Munson.
Munson present.
Representative Stevenson.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Members, we have a quorum. We also have minutes from March 17th, 2022. Representative Akam, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I move approval.
Representative Akam moves approval of the minutes from March 17th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The amendments are adopted. Members, we have a full hearing today. We have six items on the agenda. It's our last hearing before we get into our budget omnibus week. And so we're going to have a tight time schedule with 15 minutes per agenda item, split half between the presenters and member questions. And first, we will hear a presentation on the Metropolitan Council's Zero Emissions Bus Transition Plan. And I would like to welcome first Nick Thompson. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Nick Thompson, Deputy General Manager, Capital Programs at Metro Transit. I am going to share my screen and briefly go through our zero emission bus plan with you. Are you seeing that?
Yes, we are.
Okay, thank you. So last year's legislature passed a law that requested that required Metro Transit to create and develop and submit the zero emission bus plan, and we submitted that to the legislature on February 15th. I'm just going to highlight a few of the top level of this of that zero emission bus plan. So we set a goal to that we would, between the next 5 years, which is our capital improvement program horizon, that at least 20% of our 40-foot bus replacements would be electric. 40-foot bus, for those who do not know, that's our majority of our buses that we have. So we've set this target, and I'll talk a little bit how we got to this target. And then the 5 years after that, we will be evaluating what our targets should be for replacing our existing diesel fleet with electric based on a series of performance indicators that we developed in our plan. Oops. The key performances, one is from a mission standpoint, but also this is a newer technology. We absolutely have to have a reliable technology to put our transit on the street. We have to understand, we've had some electric buses, but we really need to understand how reliable they are, what our maintenance record is, what our cost per mile is, and also our equity and environmental impacts of that. And those are measures that we've developed that will help guide us our investment strategies over time. The guiding principles that this zero emission bus plan created with the input of our stakeholders were around a few key areas. Number one, is it technically viable? This is, again, a new technology. It's changing rapidly. And does it fit within our fleet, and can we operate it within and provide the service we need to provide? From an equity and environmental justice standpoint, we want it where we put the buses, where we put the fleet is very key for where the benefits need to be derived and who benefits from that. And fiscal impact is a very important part. Currently, this is a technology that is more expensive than our existing fleet type. Though we do anticipate that price is going to come down very quickly, but it must be fiscally prudent investment strategy for how fast we adopt this and where we deploy it. The zero emission bus plan identified several barriers and risks to adoption that helped us in setting what our goal would be. You know, we're switching over from a diesel fleet to an electric fleet, so we really got to understand our electrical grid capacity. There's a lot of draw that we have a very large fleet, so it's got to be that can work with our utilities. We anticipate we'll be charging these at our bus garages, so we need to really understand what kind of energy load is needed at the garages and how we can convert those garages to being able to charge buses in the overnight. A very important thing we found is, you know, what is the capacity of the manufacturers in the supply chain to deliver a fleet? That was one of the key constraints that we had identified for how fast we could convert our fleet over. And just how rapidly the technology is evolving. The life, charging, how far you can go on one charge is rapidly improving. So understanding that and how it fits within our operations was important. From a funding standpoint, the governor's proposal has a $3.2 million budget, supplemental budget request. This would be to match a federal request for up to four buses. We are pursuing a federal grant right now that is due on May 31st for an additional 15 buses. The new bipartisan infrastructure bill creates significant opportunities for electric buses and getting federal funding into the replacement of our buses that will allow us to match our plan. And then we just received a grant last year that we've secured an order for eight buses that we anticipate will be coming online soon, in addition to the electric fleet that we already have on the system. So that was just a real quick overview. The Zero Emission Bus Plan is available and has been submitted, and we're happy to answer questions after testimony.
Thank you so much. We have one more presenter in this segment, and that is Joshua Hudick with the Sierra Club. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Long and committee members. My name is Joshua Hudick. I'm a senior program manager on transportation with the Sierra Club Minnesota North Star chapter, representing 80,000 members and supporters in every county, every district across our great state. I want to underline that we want fewer Minnesotans to suffer from the effects of climate change and breathing toxic diesel fumes and racial injustice. And Clean Cars Minnesota was a huge win for our state last year, but it's really just part of the transportation emissions pie. We need to decrease the harmful emissions and environmental climate impacts of dirty diesel buses running in communities across the Twin Cities and the state, really, that are disproportionately affected by air pollution. The capital city of Wisconsin is doing this. They're transitioning their buses, 27 of them, to zero emission electric buses. Duluth is doing it. Their recently announced net zero climate emissions goal includes clean electric buses. And you just heard from Mr. Thompson about Metro Transit doing it. So thank you for finding room in your budget to make these critical investments to electric transit. But providing funds at the state level can also unlock and match federal investment dollars for electric buses. And that means we can more rapidly deploy Metro Transit's zero emissions bus plan. I'll just leave you with a little factoid that although medium and heavy duty vehicles comprise only 10% of the vehicles on the road, they account for more than 25% of the climate pollution and 45% of nitrogen oxide emissions for the entire transportation sector. And as I said, these emissions are linked to asthma, bronchitis, cancers, and premature deaths, and disproportionately impact people of color in marginalized communities. So it's not just a climate justice issue, it's a racial justice issue. And thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much. We have 5 minutes for questions, and we'll start with Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To start, I do want to thank Mr. Thompson for your presentation. I think you outlined something in there that's really important, supply chains, right? You talked a lot about how this electric bus transition We're really worried about our supply chains right now, the nickel, the copper, the cobalt needed. So I really appreciate you recognizing that because that is really important. But my question actually is going to be for Mr. Hudak. You know, you talked a lot about how electric buses are going to be really important for racial justice and inequities, climate, environment, right? So how do you feel then that since we don't have a supply chain right now for these minerals, that we'll be taking them from marginalized countries like the Congo, where there's child and slave labor, where there's no environmental standards, where there's no labor standards? Aren't you just pushing the problem somewhere else and somewhere a lot more extreme when we could be focusing more on issues here in the state?
Mr. Hodek.
Thank you for the question, Representative. We do see massive increases in research and development of this technology and the battery. Oh, sorry, my desk just collapsed. Speaking of technology, the deployment and technology in these batteries are increasing and improving every day. So what we are relying on today for these batteries is not what we're going to be relying on tomorrow. We need to start investing now. So when the technology is there tomorrow, we're prepared. So this is the future. We're seeing it in every municipality across the country. And like I said, I just mentioned Madison, Wisconsin, across the border is doing this. You know, we just want to be there prepared.
Representative, I go quick follow-up, and then I have to go to Representative Horst.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Hodak. And I appreciate your talking about technology, but technology is not going to change the critical minerals that we need. And I think we should be thinking about making sure we secure our supply chains here rather than destroying the world around us just so you feel better here in Minnesota. Thank you.
Representative Hornsey.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And this is something that we've talked a lot about in the Transportation Committee, and we definitely are looking at accessing the federal funds that Mr. Thompson talked about. I actually had my hand up before Mr. Hodek made my point, but I'll still ask Mr. Thompson a question about it, which is that there are lots of other municipalities adopting this. And my understanding is that Toronto, for example, is a city that has really gone very aggressively towards electric buses. And I'm wondering, you know, Mr. Thompson, if you're aware of sort of their plans and maybe other cities in addition to what Mr. Hodek talked about that are really adopting this and also have zero emission transition plans.
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hartstein, Toronto is one of our peer agencies that we actually have interviewed and worked closely with in the development of our zero emission bus plan. We identified multiple peer regions that are kind of on similar to us to understand what they're doing for adopting and then what their plans are that helped guide our zero emission bus plan. And I would say, you know, Toronto's been a leader, but we are on par with this plan to be catch up and be on par with them. They've learned a lot. They've tested multiple different vendors and technologies, and I think that's been important for us to understand what would work in our climate and what we should do. And so we consider Toronto a great model that we've learned from, and we will be on par with very shortly.
Representative Hornsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Thompson.
Don't see our further questions. Thank you so much, Mr. Thompson and Mr. Hodek, for the information and the presentation today. Next, members, we are going to take up House File 4631, Representative Lee's bill. Representative Lee, would you like to move House File 4631 be laid over?
Mr. Chair, that is my motion.
All right. Representative Lee moves that House File 4631 be laid over. And I understand you have an author's amendment coded DE2 to get the bill in the shape you would like. Would you care to move your author's amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move the DE2 amendment, please.
All right, Representative Lee moves the DE2 amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The DE2 is adopted. Representative Lee, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for the opportunity to present House File 4631. As amended, Mr. Chair, over the last 2 years, I have had the opportunity to travel across the state as a member of the House Capital Investment Committee, and I have noticed how extreme weather has has resulted in increased precipitation, and how that has also contributed to the increased request for state infrastructure funding around, you know, flood hazard mitigation, stormwater system, and all of that. And so that really, you know, made me start thinking and questioning, you know, how much have we put into, you know, flood hazard mitigation. And nonpartisan staff had told me that, you know, just looking at the Red River Basin alone as an example, from 1997 to 2018, the state's share of flood hazard mitigation grants have totaled $368 million. And so, you know, that's a 21-year span, and the state of Minnesota has spent over $360 million in just one area of the state. And so I you know, hope that that brings an alarm to all of you as we consider how do we prepare for, you know, these different weather trends coming up for us and how we plan for our capital budgets. And I think that's why, you know, I'm bringing this bill forward, Mr. Chair. House File 4631, as amended, is a bill to appropriate funds to the University of Minnesota for a grant to the Institute on the Environment to conduct research on how the projections of future weather trends may exacerbate conditions such as drought, elevated temperatures, and flooding that can be integrated into the design and evaluation of buildings as we construct them in the state or for local units of government, and also how they factor energy costs, and also how do we factor in preventing and minimizing damage to building caused by extreme weather. And also the bill, as amended, looks at how future weather trends may weaken the ability of our natural systems to mitigate those conditions to the point where we really need to look at how do our infrastructure and the design of our infrastructure may help us mitigate, you know, climate risk to, you know, our food and wood production, how we look at, you know, reducing fire risk on forested land, and also maintaining and enhancing water quality in our natural habitats. And so the bill also requires a report by February 1st, 2025 to the committee with jurisdiction over environment policy, climate policy, capital investment, so that we could actually see, you know, what are the findings and what are the recommendations for policy changes or other legislation. And Mr. Chair, with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you so much, Representative Lee. Richard Graves, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Great, thank you. And I'll share my screen. Great. So my name is Richard Graves, and I'm the director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research in the College of Design at the University of Minnesota, and also a fellow at the Institute on the Environment. Thank you, Chair Long and Representative Lee, and members of the committee for inviting me here today to talk about the impact of a changing climate in Minnesota and research needed to understand those impacts and integrate that understanding into investment, design, and operations of infrastructure at different scales in a dynamic future. I applaud the committee for the foresight to understand the dynamic future of public infrastructure needs to operate in to provide buildings, energy, water, and other services to support our quality of life and a strong economy in Minnesota. So, you know, Minnesota's climate is already changing rapidly and will continue to do so in the foreseeable future. Temperatures are increasing, especially in winter, and larger, more frequent extreme precipitation events are occurring. Substantial warming during winter, particularly at night, and increased precipitation and heavier downpours already are affecting our infrastructure. Current predictions show in the decades ahead that we'll bring even warmer winters and nights and even larger rainfalls, along with the likelihood of increased summer heat and the potential for longer, drier spells and increased drought impacts. This graph from the National Weather Service shows one of multiple impacts of a changing climate. Minnesota has warmed 3 degrees Fahrenheit in average temperature from 1895 to 2020, while annual precipitation has increased by an average of 3.4 inches. Although Minnesota has gotten warmer and wetter since 1895, the most dramatic changes have come in the last few decades. In terms of how this impacts infrastructure, you know, the more intense rainstorms are putting stress on stormwater infrastructure. This graphic is from the Metropolitan Council that shows that, you know, infrastructure needs to operate at a variety of scales, from buildings to roads, from lots to neighborhoods to cities to watersheds, to mitigate and adapt to the impacts of these increased rain events. Not only do we have to consider increased rain events and the ability to increase floods in rivers and waterways, which has traditionally been our way to forecast those impacts to the built environment and other infrastructure, whether it's buildings or wastewater treatment plants or water treatment plants. This graphic shows that increasingly these high increased storm events are overtaxing our stormwater infrastructure and more than the design loads that they've been designed to carry. And that needs to be considered as we upgrade and adapt that infrastructure into the future. What's the most cost-effective way to deal with these effects of climate? This is shows some research that we did at the Center for Sustainable Building Research that looked at traditionally the built environment uses historic weather files to do energy simulations to design building envelopes and mechanical systems. Those weather files are based upon historic weather data that are 10, 15 years, sometimes 27 years old in their data sets. In this study, we looked at using forward-looking climate files that focused on 20 to 30 years in the future, and what would the weather be as it shifted according to the IPCC fifth assessment. And you know what we found in this study is that with the warmer winters, that the design considerations we need to take into effect, that winters are warming, summers are getting hotter, so our design strategies need to shift to think about what's the appropriate mechanical system, building envelope to respond to these changes. We need to consider sun shading of windows that we didn't used to need to consider in Minnesota to reduce heat impacts in buildings. Cooling systems are becoming more important, and heating systems need to be adjusted to work in different temperatures. So, you know, in response to all these changes, you know, a lot of the research to date has just identified additional questions that we need to consider for infrastructure in a changing climate. And so research that is needed is to apply new and emerging downscaled climate data that's looking into the future to the way we design infrastructure in Minnesota, to model the impact of a changing climate and consider how does that affect energy efficiency and other design considerations, understand the impact of a changing climate on site and water design considerations to increase resilience at a variety of scales, from site design to stormwater design to larger scale infrastructure, and then assess additional risks and impacts and develop the role infrastructure can play to reduce those impacts in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members.
Thank you so much, Mr. Graves. Any questions, members? I'm not seeing hands. I just want to thank you, Representative Lee, for bringing this bill forward, and I think we heard some compelling testimony earlier in our committee work from the insurance industry and others who are looking at the changing risks and the changing need to adapt our infrastructure and make sure we're doing the right planning. So I think this is an important bill, and I appreciate your efforts on it. Any closing remarks, Representative Lee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. You know, I really appreciate your efforts, Mr. Chair, to talk about how, you know, climate is impacting our infrastructure, you know, through costs, through, you know, the private side. And I think that for us as stewards of the public dollars, we really need to understand the impact of climate and how is that going to impact, you know, our trajectory going forward and how we plan for our capital infrastructure. And so I really appreciate the conversation and look forward to us moving this forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Representative Lee renews his motion that House File 4631 be laid over, and the bill is laid over. Next up, we have House File 3759 from Representative Akin. Representative Akin, would you care to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 3759 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Representative Akin moves that House File 3759 be laid over. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 3759 this morning. Those of you who are on the committee last year may remember that we passed a small area weather model that developed or that will develop projections on temperature, precipitation, snow cover, and other weather parameters with the intention that this information can help farmers and foresters and other land use managers, along with local units of government, be able to do their work more successfully and efficiently. So today, House File 3759 builds upon that. This bill develops an extension program to help convey the information and implications from the small area weather model to land use managers. So the existing extension program is such a trusted resource and has a statewide network that can be utilized to support this new program to help convey the information. This weather ready extension program will focus on region specific land uses such as agriculture and forestry, as well as supporting local units of government to understand and adapt their work to coordinate with our changing weather patterns. And I know we're short on time. The bill is not very complicated, so I think I'm just going to turn it over to our testifier, Dr. Heidi Roop from the University of Minnesota.
Dr. Roop, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Long and members of the committee. Let me just get the screen. Oops, apologies. Technology, maybe not my forte, but preparing our communities for changing weather extremes is my forte. And I'm here today to talk to you about how the University of Minnesota Extension Service is well positioned to help address critical needs emerging across our state as we look towards more proactive management of the impacts of changing weather extremes on our state. Our state on a whole, as you just heard, is getting warmer and wetter. We're also still managing and recovering from the stressors of events like the 2021 drought. Our ability to thrive and excel economically as a state under these increasingly variable weather conditions today and in the future depends largely on how well we both understand these risks through research, like the information that Representative Akin just shared with you that our team is generating, and how well we proactively manage for those risks. Extension Service provides services in every county across the state, and we reach over 1 million Minnesotans every year with our programming and our outreach. Yet, our dedicated team with the appropriate place-specific content knowledge and capacity to help Minnesota's agricultural sector, land and natural resource managers, and communities understand, manage, and plan for their unique climate risks and vulnerabilities remains extremely limited. With 42% of Central Minnesota farmers in 2019 reporting that they believe their farm operations will be harmed by climate impacts, this lack of capacity is a problem. And not just for our agricultural sector, this is a pattern borne out across sectors and communities across the state. Our first dedicated weather and climate resilience extension educator position was just created by leveraging the support from you all, the state legislature, for our agricultural weather study, and early financial support and leadership from the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. The Minnesota Corn Growers Association, upon hearing about this research and the fundamental data that we'll be generating to provide the state, said they had a clear need for help for the agricultural sector to help develop a climate-ready program. They came to Extension as a trusted partner in developing and providing that research and education for the agricultural sector. But of course, we need to try to provide this for more communities and more sectors across the state. This bill would create up to 10 additional extension educator and staff positions. These positions would be distributed across the state, bringing expertise and knowledge to meet the needs of our diverse communities and economic engines. they would live in and support the communities they serve. This will really close the gap between research and reports, practice, and the real world. Overall, this program will allow us to leverage existing infrastructure that Extension has distributed across the state, our trusted relationships, our research and existing funding, while bringing more capacity to Minnesotans and providing more equitable access to critical climate services. All of this will build on the legacy of Extension as a trusted go-to partner. Adding this capacity alongside the investment the state has already made in the generation of the Minnesota-specific climate data could translate into real wins right away. Increasingly, state and federal dollars are tied to an articulation of how climate risks were factored into plans and proposals. With federal infrastructure funding coming soon, we could help close one gap that would otherwise limit communities in securing these critical resources. Finally, this is an opportunity for demonstrating national leadership. As far as we can tell, this would be the first coordinated climate service program of this nature and scale within Extension nationally. However, we should be clear, the motivation here is not about being first or being biggest. It's responding to a clear need in our state, one that we currently cannot meet, and working to add capacities where our communities have clearly called for it. Thank you for your time, and I'm confident that through thoughtful, creative partnerships and investments, we can meet the moment and help all Minnesotans work together to build a better, stronger future. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Roop. Members, any questions? Well, I have a couple of quick ones. So the first one, Dr. Roop, is I appreciated the work that we funded last year on the agriculture research study. And I'm just curious if you have an update on where we're at on that. Dr. Roop.
Thank you, Chair Long. Yes, we are in full swing. We have been doing engagement with stakeholders across the state agencies, federal agency partners, tribal communities, individual farmers and others to identify what data they most need at what scale and resolution. We've been presenting our work nationally because this has set a model and many other states are interested in what we're doing. And we're getting ahead of the federal government in some ways and providing data that other regions don't have. And so there's a lot of excitement. And we also have, as I mentioned, been able to leverage your support and an early investment in this program with partners like the private sector with the Corn Growers Association to actually create new roles, to create proof of concept, to ensure that these data are actually moving out of the university onto the landscape. And so next week, we are conducting our final interviews for that individual to create this new climate extension program. And we also have been able to hire another senior level climate resilience researcher who is creating a whole range of materials and doing further engagement, all while the data and the interactive tool are being developed. So we feel ahead of schedule and are really hoping to over deliver. So thank you very much.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Dr. Roop. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Roop. So it sounds like there's one person already out on the ground, and the proposal is to add 10 more people. What would an average day look like for those new staff that would come into the state?
Dr. Roop.
Chair and Representative, thank you very much for that question. We have a compelling vision for what these individuals will be doing. We really hope to recruit and bring in expertise that are currently not necessarily well represented within Extension, including more capacity related to engineering and design, human health, more emphasis on how to incorporate long-range future planning into decisions that are happening on the landscape, whether you're a large-scale producer or a small-scale producer. And so we envision these individuals developing tailored programming and providing that education through farm days, through dedicated visits. Some of it not very exciting, but critically important, and that is sort of picking up the phone and providing dedicated services to communities that need it. Right now, our team cannot meet the demand for requests for technical support. What are our risks? How do we manage for them? What have other states been doing? Can you help us secure funding so that we can improve that bridge or that culvert or protect our community health or develop an emergency shelter? We don't yet have the capacity to do that. And so I envision these individuals being nimble and responsive, highly attuned to the needs in their communities, but also able to leverage this whole network, which is why we're talking about multiple positions, because we can bring in lots of strengths and different perspectives, and they can work in a coordinated fashion to ensure we're delivering the needed expertise to communities when they need it, and then also adapt as those needs change.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you. And so just to kind of understand, that was kind of a nice answer, but so kind of maybe help grant writing, potentially some community organizing type work, would you say is kind of probably in the ballpark?
Dr. Rupp.
Chair, Representative, thank you. I'd say less organizing and more doing what Extension does best, which is providing tailored education and research. So bringing evidence into practice. Imagine you're, say, with the corn growers, right? We are going to be working to develop dedicated evidence-based research to help inform their practice. How do you, if we know very clearly that the corn belt is shifting northwards and you're having a harder time navigating these extremes of these oscillations between, say, a drought and extreme precipitation, what does that mean for the management of your crops, for your productivity? We fortunately have a rich wealth of research that is conducted at the university across all of our campuses, across our regional outreach centers that Extension supports. And these people would be bringing not only that long range future as well as more weather, sort of weather risk management programming. We would be actually helping deliver that in the context of traditional Extension programming, education, not advocacy.
Thank you, Dr. Don't see your hand back up, Representative Swazinski. Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Chair Long. Dr. Rupp, has Minnesota received any federal funding to address, you know, the weather extremes, or did you say that we're hoping to receive some in the future? I heard a mention of federal dollars, but I did not catch what that was all about.
Dr. Rupp.
Representative Bo, thank you for that question. The mix of funding that comes to the university comes from a variety of sources and Extension. We receive financial resources, of course, from the state, from the federal government, from grants and contracts, and from philanthropic contributions to our programs. The money I specifically represented in the testimony is that we are working, and many communities are working to figure out how to secure federal dollars like those that come from the Department of Transportation, or FEMA for disaster response. And one of the barriers that we're increasingly starting to face is that communities are being required to communicate and articulate how they've factored in future climate risks into their proposals in order to secure these federal dollars, even if that's, you know, upgrading a stretch of highway. And fortunately, we are going to have those data at a resolution sufficient to meet those federal requirements, but there's still a capacity gap in actually writing down and understanding and articulating for these funding mechanisms what those risks are in those communities and how they've been determined. And the federal government has requirements around sort of whether those are peer-reviewed studies and well-adopted approaches. And so this is a service that, because we have the support of generating the actual climate data at a resolution unprecedented from our nearby neighbors, neighboring states, we can actually help communities articulate those risks so that they can then be competitive to secure those federal dollars. So that's one particular mechanism for, I think, where we would be well positioned to leverage, say, the bipartisan support for the federal infrastructure money that would be coming to the state. We hope that we could alleviate or address that one gap that would otherwise prevent communities from being successful in securing those dollars that may be tied to a very clear understanding of how climate risks have been mitigated in that proposed funding for infrastructures.
Representative Bowe, any follow-up?
Just an observation. It really sounds like work and effort needs to occur to gather the data merely to be successful to receive more funding in the future. So it kind of becomes a bit of a chasing our own tail, but it's a necessity, I think, as part of the game. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bowe. Well, and we did fund the data last year, and so I think this is a real natural extension, if you will, of trying to make sure the data gets out to the public and is well used. And it's good to hear that there's such demand for this information. And so I think sounds like our funding was well placed last year. Representative Aikman, any closing comments?
Well, I just thank you for the conversation this morning. I appreciate the expertise of Dr. Roop and for her joining us, and just really think that this would be a beneficial program to be able to help educate land use managers to make our state competitive for potential federal funding through the infrastructure bill, the federal infrastructure bill. So I just really appreciate the opportunity, and I renew my motion that House File 3759 be laid over.
Representative Akam renews her motion that House File 3759 be laid over, and the bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative Akam. Next up, we have House File 3985 from Representative Christensen. Representative Christensen, would you care to move House File 3985 be laid over?
Yes, that is my motion, Mr. Chair.
All right, Representative Christensen moves House File 3985 be laid over. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am pleased to present House File 3985, which would provide additional funding and a couple program enhancements to the Community Energy Transition Grant Program. The grant program was created, as you will remember, in 2020 to support communities that will face dramatic impacts of the retirement of some of the state's largest investor-owned power plants. This includes the city of Oak Park Heights in my district, where Xcel's Allen S. King coal plant is now slated for retirement by 2028. That's about a decade ahead of time, by the way, so that's why we're feeling a little bit of urgency here to get some help for the communities. I'm grateful for the bipartisan support of this proposal, and I've received a lot of support from my colleagues both here and in the Senate. In addition to Oak Park Heights, other communities that stand to benefit from these grants include Becker, Cohasset, Monticello, Red Wing, Granite Falls, White Lakes, and Fergus Falls. Testifying in support of the bill today is Max Peters from the city of Cohasset, and Shane Zart of the Coalition of Utilities Cities is also available for questions if you need them. Thanks much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. Mr. Peters, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Long and members of the committee. My name is Max Peters. I'm the Director of City Operations for the City of Cohasset and serve as the President of the Coalition of Utility Cities. I'm here today in support of House File 3985 because my city is host to Minnesota Power's Boswell Coal Plant, making Cohasset one of the communities in the state that faces the potential for major social and economic impact as a global energy landscape changes. Property taxes attributable to the Boswell plant make up more than 70% of our city's tax base, and the plant provides high-quality jobs that pay well above the median average for our area. Last year, Minnesota Power announced that they would retire one of the two remaining coal-fired plants in Boswell in 2030, with plans to retire the final unit in 2035. The Community Energy Transition Grant Program was created in 2020 with bipartisan support to help communities like Cohasset plan for and navigate these transitions. But additional support is needed, and unfortunately, communities outside of Xcel Energy's service territory were not eligible for the first round of grants. In 2020, the legislature appropriated $2 million from the Renewable Development Account, which resulted in one round of grants to communities within Xcel's service territory. This bill would appropriate $5 million in general funds to the program for an additional round of grants available to a broader set of communities, including Cohasset. There are also a couple changes to the underlying program in this bill. The first is a clarification to the eligibility language that would include communities where the plant's current licensure expires within the next 15 years. This is meant to target cities where plant retirement is possible in the relatively near future, but plans are not spoken to in a current integrated resource plan. This is the case for the city of Red Wing. Another change would modify the program from offering grants on a competitive basis to a rolling application basis. There are a small number of host communities eligible for these grants, and we work together and learn from one another. Offering grants on a rolling rather than competitive basis will allow communities to work more collaboratively with DEED as needs arise rather than competing against one another through each grant cycle. The communities that did receive grants last year have done great work with them. The city of Becker received a grant to support their work to enhance sewer and water infrastructure to enable expansion of the city's business park to help diversify their city's tax base to better prepare for retirements that are just around the corner. Monticello used grant funds to create a strategic action plan, taking a long-range look at using time that community has before plant retirement to take a systematic approach to prepare for the community's transition. In Oak Park Heights, funding went to provide technical support and analysis to a King Plant advisory panel convened by the city, which is helping to identify options for reuse and redevelopment of the King Plant site. Without access to this program, here in Cohasset, we have pursued an aggressive economic development strategy alongside Minnesota Power and other partners to help prepare for this transition, but we are working against the clock. This program is an essential tool for the state to support transitioning communities and can work hand in hand along with efforts the state is making through the Energy Transition Office housed at DEED. On behalf of Cohasset and my colleagues in other utility cities, I urge you to include this legislation in your omnibus bill and work to ensure that all host communities around the state are eligible to participate. In closing, I want to note that Shane Zart, who represents the Coalition of Utility Cities, is in attendance and available to answer any questions from members. Thanks again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Peters. Questions, members? Well, I think, Mr. Peters, you did a good job of updating us on where the funding has been used that we've allocated to date and what the additional uses would be put to. So I appreciate this, and I appreciate Representative Christensen, you bringing this bill forward. I think this is a really important part of making sure that we're standing by communities who are seeing transitions through no fault of their own and wanting to make sure that we're helping support those communities through that transition. Seeing no further hands, Representative Christensen, would you care to make any closing comments to your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. I just look forward to your continued support of these communities. I'd like to thank Max Peters for his very, very informative testimony. So thank you for that. And Shane Zart, of course, who's our guidance counselor. So thanks much, everyone.
Representative Christensen renews her motion that House File 3985 be laid over, and the bill is laid over. All right, the next bill we have up is House File 4653, Representative Hollins. Representative Hollins, would you care to move that House File 4653 be laid over?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. That is my motion.
All right, Representative Hollins moves that House File 4653 be laid over. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. This is the bill for electric school bus pilot program. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency emission calculator estimates that the replacement of every diesel bus with an electric bus will eliminate 54,000 pounds of greenhouse gas emissions annually. Conversion from diesel to electric buses also provides cost savings for school districts. Pilot programs in other states have indicated that operations and maintenance costs for electric buses can be up to 60% less expensive than their diesel buses. And when fuel reduction is factored in, studies have shown a savings of roughly $7,000 per bus annually. Anyone who has ridden in a school bus knows what it's like to sit in a cloud of diesel fumes. It is unpleasant, and research suggests that this forced exposure to air pollution is having measurable negative effects on our students in a variety of ways. Diesel exhaust has been repeatedly demonstrated to have negative impacts on the health of children, especially children with asthma and other upper respiratory issues, which is especially relevant now that we're in our sort of semi-post-COVID times. And diesel exhaust is also a known carcinogen with ties to lung cancer. Furthermore, a study conducted in Georgia showed that school districts that had invested in cleaner running school buses had higher standardized test scores than those who did not. So for those reasons alone, I think we really need to reconsider how we transport our children to school. House File 4653 is a fairly permissive bill, which allows utility companies to opt in to a program to file with the commission to promote the deployment of electric school buses. With this program, if a school district chooses to purchase one or more electric school buses, the public utility can provide a rebate to the school district for the difference in cost between an electric school bus and the standard school bus. The school district would be responsible for the maintenance and upkeep of said electric school bus, and the school district and utility companies would work together to deploy the school buses where there's chronically poor air quality. This is a smart bill that benefits school districts, students, and utility companies alike. I have two testifiers today, and I would like to turn it over to them.
Terrific. First, we will hear from Jeff Nelson. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. Mr. Nelson, you need to unmute.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for the chair of the committee and members of the committee. I'm Jeff Nelson, a retired family physician. I'm here to support the legislation to hasten the transition to electric school buses to benefit all of us. Until I retired, I was not aware of the medical research that shows the clear health and economic benefits of switching to electric vehicles. Air pollution is primarily caused by internal combustion vehicles. It has been shown to play a role in 10% of the deaths in the Twin Cities every year, according to a recent MPCA report, with similar numbers for the rest of our state. Unless it is severe, air pollution is not noticed, but even low levels have been shown to worsen asthma as well as other lung and heart disease and increase the rate of cancer. Air pollution has also been shown to reduce the academic performance of our students in school. If you attend school in an area with worse air pollution, such as being downwind from a major highway or street, average student performance in school is poorer than if you attend a school with better air quality. Many minority students are disproportionate by this fact. A 2017 study from the Harvard Public Health School showed that even a small increase in air pollution does significantly increase the rate of death in the Medicare population, even with short-term exposure for just 1 to 2 days. I wear blue and red clothing today because this is not a Democrat or Republican issue. This issue affects all of us. We must be fiscally responsible. We should get the best bang for our buck. Even though the initial cost of an electric school bus is almost 3 times higher than a diesel or gas-powered bus, the overall cost of ownership looks to be very similar because electric vehicles require less maintenance and their electric fuel costs less. Using electricity produced by clean energy and avoiding the use of oil and gas also benefits our national security by not relying on nations controlled by dictators for our energy needs. According to the American Lung Association, a widespread transition to zero emission transportation, such as electric school buses, can annually save up to $72 billion in avoided healthcare costs. This return on investment is likely to be one of the best that the state of Minnesota can make. In conclusion, any investment that improves school performance, improves the health of our students, and our senior citizens, and saves money is worthwhile. All the citizens of our state, but especially our students, will benefit from this investment. The Zero Emission Transportation Association published a white paper in January of 2022 that gives many more details regarding this issue. Thank you for your time and consideration. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nelson. Next, we'll hear from Thomas Lucy. Please introduce yourself and proceed. Mr. Lucy with us?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Holland.
I was notified just recently that Mr. Lucy might not be able to be okay. Here. He is a public school teacher. He did send me his testimony if you would like me to read it.
I think we'll maybe just put that in the record if that works for you.
That works for me.
All right, sounds good. We'll proceed with member questions and first Representative Igo.
Hey, Mr. Chair. Talking about Mr. Nelson, your testimony there, you mentioned that the cost of these buses is usually 3 times as much. And research from the city of Duluth and the Twin Cities shows that we need 3 times as many buses if we're going to go electric because of range and cold, et cetera. So now we're talking about a lot of expense for our buses. And you also mentioned getting away from oil and gas makes us more reliable as a country. So then I hope you also support me then when I'm a little upset that we're going to be putting kids on buses that have been made because kids mined the materials for those buses. So I get a little upset when we're going to continue to push, electrification here without steady supply chains, especially when we don't have data to affect greater Minnesota. I don't know of an electric bus that could do the bus route that I had to ride as a kid that took me out 17 miles into the country on snowy roads. So more or less not a question, but just a comment that we need to think about the bigger picture here when we're going to start influxing money into IOUs and we're going to start doing this kind of stuff, because we're not really making a problem any better. We're just pushing it somewhere else and ignoring it here in Minnesota.
Representative Hollins, looked like you wanted to respond.
I didn't mute myself. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Igo, for pointing that out. I think that the key here is that it is a pilot program and that we are asking schools to opt in, so it's not required. And we certainly have talked to a lot of the school districts as well as the school bus drivers about the range of what these buses can do and where there would be shortcomings, and also recognizing that the technology is moving forward incredibly quickly. And so, while they might not have the range for some of our school districts, for many of them, they absolutely do. And some other pilot programs that have been using them have shown that it worked quite effectively. And the final thing I'll say is that, we have several bills out there about recycling electronics, and I would love to earn your support so that we could make sure that we aren't using children in the Congo to access the materials that we need in order to continue working towards a green future. Thank you.
Looks like Mr. Lucy has joined us. So we'll turn to Mr. Lucy for your testimony, if you'd like to introduce yourself for the record and proceed. You'll need to unmute.
Am I unmuted now?
Yes, you are.
All right. Great. Thank you all. Yeah, for the record, yeah, Tom Lucy. I am a St. Paul resident and a social worker with the St. Paul Public Schools. And yeah, I will just go ahead and read my testimony. All right. So like I said, my name is Tom Lucy, and I'm a proud member of the St. Paul Federation of Educators and a social worker in St. Paul Public Schools. Thank you for the chance to speak to you all today. As someone who works in education, I work every day to give our kids the tools they need for a successful future. As an educator, I get a front row view of the joy when a student learns to read, when they figure out that math problem, when they learn about their history, and when they make new friends, and when they grow into the person they were meant to be. In spite of these wonders, it is hard to know that due to our inaction on the climate crisis, these students who we support are having their very future stolen from them. That is why, to fight for their futures, I and others within the St. Paul Federation of Educators are working to inspire climate action locally. We are working in collaboration with St. Paul Public Schools, the City of St. Paul, and community advocates to develop renewable resources in St. Paul schools to reduce waste, to reduce pollution, and to create a healthy and sustainable school district and larger community. In fighting for our students' future, we're also looking to act in creating a cleaner transportation system. This is particularly important as it is a growing source of emissions and is something that pollutes the lungs of our students every day. To address this, we need local action to rethink what our travel options are and systemic action to change the entire transportation system. We need to utilize clean forms of travel, such as electric school buses. We need the leadership of the state government to give districts like SPPS the opportunity to begin to transition to an electric fleet of vehicles and buses. With every step forward we take on that effort, we reduce greenhouse gases and we lessen the daily pollution our children live with and ride with. Again, thank you for allowing me to speak. I'm thankful to this committee for leading this work. We in SPFE are eager to work with you and are excited about the changes we can all make together for our kids. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Lucy, for joining us and for your testimony. I just have one question that I'd like to ask, and just wanted to note in response to our Representative Igo's comments, you've continued to be consistent in raising this issue, and I do agree that supply chain issues are important. I think noted in this committee before that those are issues that we're going to need to address at the national level, although we have a bill coming up next that's going to be talking about supply chain issues as well. But you made your comment on a computer that uses a lithium ion battery that is produced by the same supply chains. You probably talked on a cell phone this morning that also has a lithium ion battery that is using the same supply chains. And we are seeing this as an issue that is not unique to one particular industry. This is an issue that applies to all of our electronics and certainly needs to be addressed. But Representative Hollins, I think I appreciate you're trying to address a real issue, which is that kids are dying and getting sick in our communities because of diesel pollution from school buses. We know that asthma is the leading cause for why kids are missing school. And I think the reports that Mr. Nelson mentioned about the 10% of all deaths in the Twin Cities Metro, and I think it was similar numbers in the Duluth and Rochester area, are from air pollution, which means it's the third highest cost, highest reason for death in the state in those areas. It's after cancer and heart disease. So Mr. Nelson, I'm just curious if you can talk about, as a practicing a family doctor, what you saw in terms of air pollution impacts on some of the individuals you worked with and what lung disease meant for some of those families and individuals. Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Chairman Long. So I worked in Cottage Grove for over 38 years as a family physician, and the it has only been more in the last 10 years that we've had good scientific studies to show a direct relationship. I had many, both children and adults with asthma. I had many people who suffered from a variety of cancers. In fact, I died from brain cancer back in 2016. We'll never know for sure the cause of her cancer, but she was entirely healthy. She had no risk factors. She never smoked. I mean, it's sort of like, okay, why did she get brain cancer? And again, you have to be careful in the individual circumstance to not draw conclusions. But when we look at the data that is out there, in particular, the study that I referred to from 2017 by the Harvard Public School of Health, that is a very strong study that shows that even at a low level, air pollution causes significant trouble in terms of illness and premature death. And so that is something that makes sense that we all should pay attention to, again, for the sake of everyone. Thank you, Chairman Long, and thank you, Representative Hollins, the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Representative Igel.
Thank you, Chairman Long. If I could just respond to some of the comments you made. You're right. I am doing this meeting right now through a computer. I wish we were in person. I do talk on my phone every day. The difference, the crystal clear difference between you and me is that I come here every day and advocate for wanting to bring this stuff here rather than continuing to introduce bills to increase the supply and demand from around the world. That's the difference here. So don't try to lump me in with you when you're saying that I'm just going along with it. I'm actually advocating for it. I write bills for it. I speak on it. And I try to get bills heard in this committee about it, but I never get a response from you, even if I send you an independent email or ask to talk to you. So don't point me out like that and try and lump me out of this, because I don't think that's fair. I think that's really inappropriate of you to do so. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Igel. Representative Hollins, any closing remarks to your bill?
Thank you, Chair Long. I want to thank my testifiers and the committee for hearing this bill. I think the most important aspect of this bill for me is how it would allow school districts to provide tangible display of their commitment to address climate change. Our students are taught to recycle and to save energy and turn off the lights when they're not using them and respect nature. And yet every morning they wait at their bus stops for these outdated diesel buses that spend half their time idling and spewing exhaust. This bill provides school districts with an opportunity to practice what they preach and show students every day the commitment that they've made. And with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 4653 be laid over for possible inclusion in omnibus.
Representative Hollins renews her motion that House File 4653 be laid over, and the bill is laid over. Our final bill up for the day is House File 1978. From Representative Listlegard. Representative Listlegard, would you care to move that House File 1978 be laid over?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Listlegard moves that House File 1978 be laid over. And I understand you have an author's amendment coded DE2. Would you care to move the author's amendment to get the bill in the shape you would like?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Listlegard moves the DE2 to get the bill in the shape he would like. Any discussion to the DE2? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? The DE2 is adopted. Representative Lislegard, please tell us about your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to offer this bill to support Minnesota and American jobs by moving towards a buy clean, buy fair policy for procurement. With the passage of the Federal Infrastructure Act, there will be major investments in Minnesota's transportation and building infrastructure. This investment should reward Minnesota and American manufacturers that are currently making their products cleaner and safer than their global competitors. It is also important that Minnesota's taxpayers are supporting good, family-sustaining American jobs. Buy clean, buy fair policy will help create the transparency needed to incentivize good actors within the industry. This bill, as amended, would set up an advisory council for state agencies, businesses, labor to come up with recommendations for how we could move forward with the state for projects that would prioritize minerals like steel, cement, and asphalt, and others as they come online that are made the right way by workers who make a fair wage and companies that are committed to protecting the environment. Too many American manufacturers have moved production overseas so they can take advantage of cheaper labor and worse pollution standards. But the state of Minnesota is a significant market participant as a producer of construction materials. And we can make sure that we're going to be buying products that are made right. We can provide an incentive to companies to keep the jobs here and to make the products in a clean and safe manner. This will help step towards leveling the playing field for American workers. That's what this bill is about. The advisory council will begin the process of gathering the necessary data for our state agencies to understand where they're getting these products and how they are manufactured. It can also make sure that our Minnesota Buy Clean, Buy Fair policy integrates with the federal Buy Clean executive order issued by President Biden. The advisory council will report back to the legislator with recommendations on which minerals should be covered and what standards should be taken to make sure the construction materials on our taxpayers are taken into consideration. The report is due December 31st, 2030 or 2023, and it would be up to the legislator to finalize the standard and put them in place. And I'm proud to say that I have a dear friend and a labor colleague, John Arbogast, joining us today. And I believe I also have Kevin Paranis here as well.
You do, Representative Lislegard. First, we'll turn to Mr. Arbogast. Please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed.
Thanks, Chair Long, committee members. My name is John Arbogast. I'm a staff rep with District 11, United Steelworkers. I'm up here on the Iron Range in Eveleth, Minnesota. My, my daily functions are help the companies run five of the six taconite mines here in northern Minnesota. I think that I'm totally in support of Representative Lislegard's bill that creates an advisory committee to establish a buy clean and buy fair Minnesota policy. The committee should include industry, labor, the government, and what we should be doing is incentivizing the companies that are willing to produce buy clean materials, which all starts with the taconite here on the Iron Range. And then if we incentivize for these companies that do want to buy clean, buy fair, make the products here in Minnesota, maybe that will encourage some of the other companies to join us in this fight. Our foreign competitors, we've known for years when it comes to steel, they're government subsidized. They illegally dump the steel into our country. And what is the carbon footprint that these companies are putting on the world? Yeah, we do it cleaner here in Minnesota. Our steel mills in the United States do it clean. It's fair. It's union workers. If we're really concerned about the world's carbon footprint, we need to do it in this country. And one of the things that has came up you know, during a few times, is there is child labor. And these companies do not do anything to stop polluting the world. And why should we help them? And why should we let their products come into this country that are illegally subsidized, things like child labor, no environmental concerns? We should start this committee and look at how do we help those that do it the right way, because that's what we're, it's not just a Minnesota, you know, if we clean things up in Minnesota, U.S. Steel and Cleveland-Cliffs have committed to 2030, reducing their carbon footprint. But if we just keep buying stuff from Vietnam, China, Russia, India, are we really helping our carbon footprint? We need to make the steel in this country. We need the jobs in northern Minnesota. All of you know that when we start to have our layoffs, historically going back to the 80s, when we had all these steel workers, it was Japan that was dumping the steel. We've had how many layoffs lately? And it's all because of illegally government-subsidized steel. But we're talking about energy and the carbon footprint. And we just can't turn a blind eye to what these foreign companies do. We have this infrastructure bill. It's a once-in-a-generation bill. If we're going to fix the crumbly infrastructure in Minnesota, whether it be roads, pipes, building, bridges, let's incentivize clean, fair steel from Minnesota, the starting point with our pellets. Thank you, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you so much, Mr. Arbogast, for your testimony. Next, we will hear from Kevin Prentice. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Long. My name is Kevin Prentice, and I'm the marketing manager for Liuna, Minnesota in North Dakota, a union that represents 28,000 skilled construction laborers and their family members across Minnesota and North Dakota. I want to begin by thanking Chair Long and the members of the House Climate and Energy Committee for the opportunity to address you today, and especially to Representative Liz Lagarde for proposing Buy Clean, Buy Fair legislation, as well as many other bills that he's authored that directly benefit our members and working people generally. I'm speaking to you today actually from Virginia, just down the road from Mr. Arbogast, where I'm up at our local 1097, where many of our members depend greatly on the mining industry for their livelihood. And we believe that this bill is important because it has the potential to advance the competitiveness of Minnesota's mining, manufacturing, and construction industries. I've had opportunity to talk to construction contractors and their customers, both in my role with Liuna Construction Union and as a member of Governor Walz's Climate Advisory Council, which has been conducting interviews, in particular focusing on businesses and civic organizations trying to understand what the energy transition means for them and how we maximize the benefits and minimize the negative impacts to Minnesota. So many at this point, and contractors will tell you this, many private companies and public agencies are seeking construction services, and they're looking for strategies to reduce their carbon footprint, including the carbon that's embedded in building materials, particularly steel and concrete. Buy Clean and Buy Fair would help them provide better solutions for getting to those lower embedded carbon buildings that allow them to meet their own climate goals, in particular private sector climate goals. And it would do this first by ensuring that the state of Minnesota is leading by example, as some other states are, in our own, you know, if we're saying that these goals are important and that we want to prioritize industries that actually use the lowest pollution, lowest carbon processes, those are disproportionately Minnesota and U.S. industries, and we should be putting our money where our mouth is and supporting the industries that do it right, like our mining industry here in Minnesota. But equally important, or maybe more importantly, Buy Clean, Buy Fair would bring greater transparency. The challenge that our contractors have who are trying to put forward proposals to customers for their reducing their embedded carbon is there's not enough supply chain transparency for them to know what, how much carbon or how many other pollutants are embedded in different products, where do those products come from, what are the options that are available, and what are the price points that would allow a customer to spend a little bit more to get a much better value rather than spending a lot more. And that's a challenge. The contractors can't offer the products that the customers want. So if you know this bill would provide that transparency, would allow the market to function more efficiently, contractors to give better options to customers, encouraging everything from the siting of corporate headquarters to the purchase of Minnesota-made minerals, Minnesota-made manufactured products. And the last point I would make is that the advisory committee is a small but important step to moving this forward. We understand to get the process really benefits these companies and is easy to use by industry. And they're imagining that, you know, from the advocacy perspective, we get there by bringing business and other stakeholders together to figure out the best information, the way that works with the least red tape, with the best information in order to benefit Minnesota businesses and Minnesota workers. Thank you very much for your time, and I'm open for any questions.
Thank you so much, Mr. Pranis. Looks like we do have some questions for Representative Aiken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation today, and thank you, Representative Liz Lagarde, for bringing the bill forward. It's more of a comment than a question, and it's really just to say thank you to Representative Liz Lagarde for bringing this forward. I think that this task force will be an important step to, as you know, climate issues are incredibly important to me, and so having this task force look at the environmental impacts and also greenhouse gas emissions in our as we develop these supply chains and strengthen them, I think is really important. And I appreciate the thought that's gone into this, and I look forward to hearing what the results of it are. So thank you for bringing it forward. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Aiken. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I too just wanted to weigh in and thank Representative Liz Lagarde for his consistent work in this area. The bill represents some of the things we can do at the state level to help companies and workers and address some of the worldwide market issues that we've been talking about a bit on this committee. So whether it's energy or healthcare, these task forces help get us the information we need to make better decisions. So just wanted to thank Representative Liz Lagarde for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. I'll add my thanks as well, Representative Liz Lagarde. You've been really tireless on this issue and brought me out firsthand to Toledo, Ohio to tour Cleveland Cliffs HBI facility, which is using all Minnesota iron ore and is achieving a 50% greenhouse gas reduction over traditional methods. So, you know, we're seeing this in practice, what our Minnesota companies are doing, particularly in the steel industry. Cleveland Cliffs is a 25%, I believe, reduction target by 2030. U.S. Steel has set a net zero target. They're both, you know, being real leaders in this space. And we know that's not true for their competitors around the world. So when we here in Minnesota are using our tax dollars to build infrastructure, and we know we buy a lot of steel, we put a lot of concrete down, right, to build our buildings and asphalt for our roads, we should be using our dollars the best we can to make sure that those are going towards companies that are doing the right thing. And those companies tend to be those located here in Minnesota that are producing good Minnesota jobs. So I just want to thank you for your advocacy on this. And I know we had a report that we heard earlier in session on looking at the work that's been done so far in state. And I think this task force will build off of that report that we were able to pass last year and make sure that we're gathering a lot of feedback in what would be a really big step for our state to be a leader in this space and make sure that we're using our tax dollars well. So thank you, Representative Liz Lagarde, for all your hard work. I don't see further hands up. Representative Liz Lagarde, would you like to make closing comments to your bill?
I would just like to thank everyone. And we're very proud of what we do up in Northeast Minnesota. And I know the people on this committee are very passionate about the climate and wanting to do the right thing the right way. And this legislation, this advisory group is gonna bring stakeholders together. So whatever we come with, it's gonna be something that is workable and that is sustainable, matching up with what the feds are going to do. We live in a global economy, but we also live in a global environment. And I believe that, you know, this country was founded on ingenuity and people with hope and faith to do great things. And I believe the state of Minnesota can lead. I think that we need to be prudent in laying this out. And before we can give a recommendation, we actually need to bring everybody together. And that's why this is so important. I'm very, very proud of John Arbogast and Kevin Prentice. I'm glad that he's up on the range. Banner Range is significant and in its role in this state and in this country. And we really appreciate all your support. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Lisselgard. Representative Lisselgard renews his motion that House File 1978 be laid over, and the bill is laid over. Members were a little ahead of schedule, which I think is a rare thing in the Climate and Energy Committee. So I'll just give a quick preview before we adjourn for next week. We are going to be posting our budget omnibus bill, our DE amendment and spreadsheet on Monday. And then on Tuesday, we will be doing a walkthrough and taking any member questions on the bill. On Wednesday, we will hear from the public and have public testimony. And then on Thursday, we will be taking up amendments to the bill. The amendment deadline will be 3 p.m. on Wednesday. And if we don't finish our work on Thursday in our meeting, we'll continue in a subsequent meeting. So that's the path from here, members. And thank you for the hard work to get us to the point we're at today. And with that, we are almost. All right, Representative Swazinski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just and that next Thursday then will be the last meeting that we have.
That'll be the last meeting for regular session. I certainly reserve the right to have meetings after deadline, but I don't have any plan at the moment.
Sounds good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski. All right. With that, members, we are adjourned.